ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
I mean, why didn't they just use Harry Holt's high school nickname, Puss? These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
Search The Dead Can't Sue podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party: change or die.
The public are sick and tired of being ignored.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Ngunnawal country in Parliament House, Canberra.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney. And PK, here we are back again. Can't help ourselves. This time for question time.
Now, we can't help ourselves and you can't help yourselves either. We've got lots of your questions.
So many. Great.
Yeah. That's how we know that these are worth doing, because you've always got more questions. These episodes are like political brain teasers for us. I've got to say the standard episodes are easier because I'm in the news cycle. I know what's happening. I've spoken to people. I can tell you. But these ones keep me on my toes.
Yeah, they're testing.
Before we get to them, though, we need to give Party Rumours a bit of a news update, I think, Fran.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. There's going to be a Senate inquiry into Telstra today. The Telstra Chief Executive Vicky Brady will appear before it, as will the Chief Financial Officer Michael Ackland. This will not be comfortable for them. This is following the outages last week. They're going to get a grilling. The Green Senator, Sarah Hanson-Young, is chair of this inquiry. She's been on the warpath. Again this morning, she said, and this is kind of like a dum-dum-dum-dum, Telstra has a lot of questions to answer. And her point is that, you know, Telstra is a for-profit company, makes billions of dollars profit, but it's running an essential service. And she said, we need better rules, better regulations, and bigger penalties. So they're going to get pretty well hammered, I think, in the Senate inquiry. The one thing I do think is interesting is that Senator Hanson-Young has now said she thinks it's time to consider nationalising 000. And this is, of course, where these outages meet the sort of life and death factor potentially. Thank heavens there has not been that emerged this time, but it has in the past. And there is an issue around 000. The government brought in a change after the Optus outages that it would kick on automatically. I think it's called Camp On to the next carrier. That worked in some cases, but it didn't work in all. So now we've got the Greens calling for consideration of nationalising 000. So I think we're going to have, you know, there's more to go in this story.
There certainly is. So that's unfolding today. We're recording this on a Friday morning. Then there's that Pauline Hanson interview with far-right agitator Tommy Robinson. That's now gone live.
And there's a lot in it, right?
Lots, including Pauline Hanson singling out the end of the White Australia policy as responsible for the beginning of migration. It lands as tensions in the minor party seem to be growing, with reports of more and more extreme comments from One Nation Senator Malcolm Roberts. And there's been renewed questions about the future leadership of the party. And we're going to go.
You just got a feel for Barnaby Joyce a little here, don't you?
Do you?
Well, funnily, I should ask that, because there are some questions coming up on this very thing.
So, shall we head into question time and get into it?
Let's do it.
We shall move to questions without notice. Are there any questions? I give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Yeah.
Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. It's time for our question time this week. Our first question comes from Craig.
Hi, PK and team. A question on the Barnaby Joyce and One Nation defection. At the time, there were rumours that he only defected from the Nationals, as Pauline Hanson was looking for a successor to the Crown and he was the one. Since the Sandwich Press Stakegate, the polling has swung favourably towards One Nation, and it appears there is no way Queen Pauline will give up the Crown anytime soon to Prince Barnaby. Has there been any murmurs or rumours of how Barnaby now sees his future in the party, given the shifting goalposts? Is it likely the young prince will only obtain the crown when the queen has gone as cold as a 30-year-old frozen Chico roll in my fridge freezer? Love the pod. Keep up the excellent work, guys. Craig from Kamilaroi Country.
Now, that is a very interesting question. Beautifully delivered as well, Craig. In
beautiful
relation
timing
to
too, Craig.
Timing is everything.
Timing is everything.
Especially in our profession, let me tell you.
And before we launch into it, PK, I think it's worth saying we had a similar question in the inbox from Scott too. So this is clearly something that is exercising people's minds and clearly something this latest podcast outing from Pauline Hanson will kick along.
It will kick it along. It'll kick it along in pretty intense way. Look, that podcast is controversial on so many levels. But let's go to the succession part of it, because that's one part. It's not all the part, but it's one part. The reason we're getting so many questions about this is clearly this party is doing very well. Pauline Hanson, of course, is, you know, not a young woman, although she seems to have a lot of energy, I've got to say. So I don't know, doesn't really... I don't know how much it matters. Like, she's in her early 70s. I can see her continuing personally. She looks like she has a lot of energy. But who's next is key, because with a party like that, it is so kind of wedded to her identity. There are deep questions about how it continues its momentum. Now, Barnaby Joyce is the obvious succession plan, right? His name ID is huge. But actually, One Nation leader Pauline Hanson has named her daughter as a potential leader of the party during that controversial podcast interview with the right-wing activist Tommy Robinson. Now, he put it to her, can I say, but she praised her daughter Lee Hanson, said she would have to prove herself because there would be no nepotism in decisions on the future of the party. But it just shows the complications here, because Hanson's daughter has also joined the party as an advisor after running for the Senate at the last federal election. She clearly has been wanting to pump up her tyres. We all want to pump up our children's tyres. It's a natural mother's instinct. But equally, she's aware of how toxic that can be, the nepotism tag, and so she's addressing it head on, but also keeping alive the idea that it could be her daughter. Although, my view... I don't know. I'm not pretending to be an expert on how One Nation succession will work, because how would I know? She's only ever been in charge of really One Nation. But I cannot see how someone with such low name recognition, other than the Hanson surname, which I'm sure carries some value, could possibly take over when Barnaby Joyce has such big name ID. I don't know, Fran, what do you think?
Well, I think it depends when. And Pauline Hanson, as you say, is showing no signs of going. In fact, it wasn't that long ago where she said, yes, she feels confident that she could lead the nation. So she's clearly, you know, with the rise in polls, thinking bigger picture. But she has been asked this a couple of times now, or mentioned her daughter a couple of times now. A little while ago, I think it was back in June, she said she wouldn't quit politics until the right people were in place. And she said, you know, I wouldn't have my sons anywhere near it, but my daughter, she's different. So again, she's talking up Lee Hanson. Well, Lee Hanson is campaigning currently as a Senate candidate for Tasmania at the next election. She told Sky News that she and her mum haven't talked about the prospect at all yet. But I would be surprised if it's not coming up now that Pauline Hanson keeps talking it up. Barnaby Joyce is brushing it off. He said the remarks from Hanson didn't bother him at all. You know, he joined the party for the philosophical change it was offering the country. But at the time, remember, when he did quit the National Party room, it was very much in the context that he was seen as the past, you know. He was not getting on with the current leader. There was no thought of promotion for him. He'd been leader twice, I think, hadn't he, of the Nats, and clearly liked that authority and thought that sat well with him. So I think there was a clear thought of, you know, transition. I wonder if it was actually spoken out about at Sandwich Gate, at that fateful evening when they had the steak in the sandwich maker. I'm suspecting there was sort of a whisper of it, but I don't know. Anyway, he says he's not bothered by it.
Yeah, perhaps not a promise. We don't have any
not a
evidence
promise,
of a promise.
Just a, you know,
but clearly
what
she
if
needs...
I won't be here forever, that kind of talk.
Yeah, that's right. And you need, you know, for a party to have legitimacy, it does help. Whatever people think of Barnaby Joyce, he has been a deputy prime minister. I think there is a wide view in definitely across politics, from Labor to Liberal to One Nation that having someone who does have that kind of level of history, being a cabinet minister, deputy prime minister, was helpful for One Nation in building its credibility as a party that could form government, right? Could be a party of government. That definitely helped.
Absolutely. I mean, he said that was part of his role, to get in there in the lower house, and, you know, he thinks they're going to get a whole lot of people elected in the next election. His role will be to keep them. It'll be like herding cats, he said. It'll be like keeping them sort of on the straight and narrow and being a potent political force. So he's seeing himself very much in, not just as an elder, I think, but as a leader to some degree.
I think that's absolutely right. He's part of his issue too, you're right, was that he was being basically put out to pasture, right?
Mm,
and he,
yeah.
His view is, I'm only, you know, what is he, 59, I think?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm not that old. And look, you know, with life expectancy now, and like 59 is not old in the current, look at the Prime Minister, he's in his 60s. So I can understand why he was frustrated with being just kind of told, you're over. And it really wasn't about age. Come on, David Little Proud. It wasn't about age. It was about him. I thought that was always a bit disingenuous of David Little Proud, who I think handled that issue very badly. I think it was very bad to lose Barnaby Joyce for the Nationals, because it's led to a little bit of a momentum shift and
was
help
it,
for
was
One
Was it
Nation.
Turnbull who called him the best retail politician in the country? Was that Turnbull?
Yeah, and then I don't think it's been consistent that he's always been a good retail
politician.
No,
not at
he's
all.
Had his moments.
He has had his moments.
Yeah.
And he's trying to create a lot more of them now.
Yeah. We had a similar question in our inbox that you mentioned from Scott. So thanks for sending both of them. And this is becoming a really interesting open question, isn't it? That Tommy Robinson interview is out today. Lots in that hour-long interview, not just the future of the leadership. That's just one element. But also some pretty contentious ideas. Ideas, can I say, that are not new from Pauline Hanson. I keep calling them her greatest hits because they are. Her anti-immigration, anti-Islam views are not, you know, oh, she's revealed she has a problem with Islam. We know she wore a burqa into the parliament. She said there were no good Muslims,
yeah,
which
no
shocked
good
people
Muslims.
On
she's
Sky
scared
News.
To go to Western Sydney, you know, scared to go to La Kemba.
So this is not brand new, but what is, I suppose, more contentious is that it's more expansive. He's a far-right influencer that even right-wing people don't want to mix with in the UK. So she's gone a step further. We've got her own office, her spokespeople saying she only did that interview because Seven Spotlight kind of, I don't know, twisted their arm or something. Like, I don't, in my experience, politicians have quite a lot of agency. And they decide who they speak to. So if really her, she was somehow twisted her arm, I don't know. Well, that seems unusual to me. Seven denies that, can I say? But like this idea, I'm sure they were looking for controversy, by the way.
Yeah,
like,
they would have loved it.
They were looking for good TV, but she could say, I don't want to talk to that guy. I'm not doing that. That's not something I want to do. I mean, that's what I do. And I think most reasonable, fair-minded people would agree with that. But I think there are bigger issues here. So it's coming as there's reporting of cracks emerging in One Nation, particularly between Pauline Hanson and Barnaby Joyce. This is something that I'm sure the coalition is salivating over. They've been waiting and arguing. People like Matt Canavan, who's friends with Barnaby Joyce, saying, oh, you watch, he can't cope with having a boss. This is going to go badly. So people are hoping it's going badly. Barnaby Joyce has been keeping it together, though, so far, saying, you know, it's not all true. He respects her, blah, blah, blah. It's all just a little bit ugly for One Nation this week, isn't it, Fran?
It is. It is. And I think things got a little bit ugly on that podcast with Tommy Robinson and Pauline Hanson because, yes, you're right, this is not new, no good Muslims and all of that. But she has gone further. I mean, she actually said that she talked about a lot of people migrating to Australia purely for the welfare system. She talked about it was quite well known that there's many Muslims in Australia who are among those ripping off the NDIS. She conceded Aussies do too, but she said quite known that Muslims do it. And she said, this is what shocked me, she said, you know, the Quran says Allah will provide. Well, the Allah providing is the taxpayer. I mean, it was pretty pointed stuff and pretty unattractive stuff and not true, according to the Health Minister, Mark Butler, who was on Radio National Breakfast this morning. He said, I'm not sure where Ms. Hanson's getting her figures from. They've never been provided to me as the Minister for Disabilities and the Minister for the NDIS. I suspect they don't exist. So, you know, it's just out and out prejudice.
Oh, absolutely. And she clearly overreached on this. You don't hear even the coalition backing it. And they themselves have talked about people who are not citizens coming off welfare. So they've already put out their own ideas about kind of, I suppose, tightening the welfare system.
Yeah, yeah.
But they
say non-citizens shouldn't access NDIS. Yeah. That's their policy now.
They haven't blamed, though, an entire migrant group for... or a religious group, it's even more specific, for the use of the NDIS rorting. I mean, the rorting in the NDIS is, you know, it's way big and much more systemic. All right, let's get to some of the other questions, Fran.
Yeah, our next one's from Will, and Will's written his question. Hi, Party Room, great show, enjoying the daily format. A question for when you get super wonky. Well, that time is now, Will. What is the history of royal commissions in Australia? We rightly celebrate compulsory preferential voting, but I think royal commissions are such an important part of our political system. When an issue becomes more important than partisan politics, especially related to institutional integrity, we have an accepted, powerful and effective process to investigate it. Part of its strength is that it's a simple remedy that's easy to unite behind for really complex and often ugly and uncomfortable societal problems. Honestly, how much progress would we have made in the last few decades absent royal commissions? Been thinking about it in the context of the Victorian building corruption and anti-Semitism royal commissions. Do other political systems, like the UK, use them as much as we do? And how can we, as citizens, keep them effective? All the best, and thanks again, Will from Melbourne.
Excellent question, Will. And because we want to give you the best answers possible on these episodes, we asked someone who is a bit of a royal commissions expert. So here's Michael Mintram, Professor of Public Policy at Monash University, having a crack at this one for you.
Thanks to Will for the question. There were some royal commissions in the colonial era in Australia in jurisdictions like New South Wales and Victoria. Royal commissions as a thing have their origins in England. They actually go back to William the Conqueror. He gave a royal mandate to compile the Doomsday Book, which gathered together information for tax purposes. That was back in 1085. For context, that's so far back there weren't parliaments, and most people back then figured the earth was flat. Other countries in the British Commonwealth hold royal commissions these days. New Zealand calls them every few years, Canada the same. Interestingly, the UK hasn't held a royal commission for more than 40 years. The first national royal commission in Australia was conducted in 1902. That royal commission investigated the mistreatment of troops returning from the Boer War. They had been transported on a crowded vessel. There was an outbreak of measles and a lot of rough stuff ensued. You can see a parallel here with the Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide established in 2021 that reported in 2024 and recommended reforming veteran support services. These two examples show the kind of matters that often lead to calling of royal commissions. A crisis event, unfortunate outcomes, different stories about what happened, and pursuit of insights into how to avoid a similar event in the future. When do royal commissions work best? My response is they work best when they have clarity of purpose. This avoids drift into adjacent matters, and it helps when they're given a deadline to report. Royal commissions don't have to run over multiple years. My view is royal commissions are most successful if they can get above the legalistic foundations they stand on. They work best when they're informed by awareness of the politics of the day and of the policy appetites of the government that will receive the recommendations. It also helps if commissioners have thought carefully about how to make change happen. There's no point making a raft of recommendations that a government is reluctant to implement. So my shorthand recipe for success is this. First, listen hard to the people on the ground who have been affected. Then, clarify the problem being addressed. Take time to learn what went wrong and what could have been managed more effectively. Use these opportunities to design policies with the affected people. And look ahead to making it easy for the proposed solutions to be adopted. When this is done, a Royal Commission can increase the odds that the government of the day will accept its recommendations. It will also increase the odds that effective changes will be made and those changes will stick. That's the best outcome. And the key thing I want to say is, to a fairly high degree, those good outcomes can be engineered.
How good is Professor Michael Mentrum? Really sorted us out there. Much better, let me tell you, Will, much better answer than I could have given you. So thank you, Michael. Thank you very much.
Well, that's
all the
right.
way back to William the Conqueror. How about that? And I think Will's point is well made. I mean, this Anti-Semitism Commission, Royal Commission, and Social Cohesion Royal Commission is tackling something very, very difficult in our society right now. We've had other, you know, significant Royal Commissions, a recent one, the Banking Royal Commission, which had real impact in exposing the issues within banking, the way citizens were getting ripped off. We didn't know. We suspected it. We were hating the banks. There's no point in that. They're an important part of our economy. And I think it really helped reset the whole relationship with the banking system. So they can, you know, they can achieve very significant remedies in our society, I think, with problems that are very difficult to deal with and that can get too bogged down in politics. And look, Michael, if you want to hear more about this, Michael was actually on Late Night Live recently talking about the history and effectiveness of Royal Commission. So we've linked that in the show notes so you can learn even more than you have here on The Party Room.
Even more? Even more. I mean, like the Royal Commissions this week, I'm more about what's been happening in the news, and we've seen the Royal Commission this week. I think it's been one of its most intense weeks, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, there's the spotlights on universities where, of course, we saw those big encampments and we saw a lot of the trouble really brewing and some of those slogans really emerged, and we first saw and took notice of those, and students on campus, Jewish students, saying that they were scared to go to uni, which is alarming. I mean, alarm bells ring when some Australian students are too frightened to go on campus because of what's going on there. So, you know, it deserved a spotlight. It got it this week, and we've had quite a number of the vice-chancellors publicly apologising for not handling it better. So again, this is contentious, freedom of speech and all of that, but I think it is an issue that really needed, the unis needed a hand with trying to wrangle, if you like, and come out with some kind of solution that is going to be agreed and have some status and standing.
It's so vexed, right, because Jewish students should be able to go to university free of this revolting harassment which conflates Israel with who they are, right?
Yeah, and hate speech, they're linked to it.
Yeah, and it's absolutely wrong, and it's important that I think there are requirements on universities to have policies which don't allow that to happen. But at the same time, universities are trying to walk a very difficult line with allowing, you know, freedom of speech and protests and everything that is historically very important in a liberal democracy, especially, can I say, on campus life, in campus
absolutely.
Life. But you, if you are making other people who want to learn not feel safe, including academics, Jewish academics that are being targeted, it's clearly unacceptable. And this is kind of the where we're at, right?
Yeah. I mean, of course, protest is bona fide in our democracy. And of course, a lot of students, like a lot of Australians, want to protest about what's been going on in Gaza. And that is valid and necessary. And, you know, human rights are human rights wherever they are. But it does seem as if things have got, as you say, people should not be frightened to go to study. And we've got to work out a way to manage this.
Yeah, and they should feel not sort of, you know, targeted the way so many have said to the Royal Commission and have been saying broadly they feel. Okay, our next question comes from Jade.
Hi, PK and Fran. Love the pod. We hear a lot about the impact of immigration on housing demand in Australia. But what I haven't heard is a discussion about our ageing population and the fact that people live longer, and the government position on ageing in place, meaning that houses are just being used for longer now and not turned over like they had been in previous generations. Just wondered what your thoughts on that was and why that's not part of the discussion in the housing debate.
It's a really interesting question, the ageing population, people staying in their homes for longer. And you're right, it's not really being discussed enough. Although, having said that, I do think there has been a little bit, maybe not the dominant part, but discussion around how to allow older people to downsize and all of that part of the discussion, including tax settings and the way we operate in our housing world so that young families can move into those spaces and that older people don't feel like they have to hold on to it because of property prices and the settings around them. Right, Fran?
Yeah, that's right. And governments for some time now have been trying to work with those tax settings to make it easier and for people to say, okay, I'm going to cop the stamp duty and move down because I get this tax exemption for some of this. I can put more money into my super, for instance, things like that. The RBA governor, Michelle Bullock, she was last year very critical of a stamp duty as a barrier to retirees downsizing. She actually identified that as an issue. ACT has got rid of stamp duty. It's an active discussion across some of the states for another number of reasons, and one of them is this. And there's also, you know, the notion of aging in place. I mean, when you're older, you don't really want to leave your community, a lot of people, and this is what's keeping people in their big family homes. And there's been, you know, surveys finding that 90% of people want the service of help to age in place. But then that's opening up conversations of, well, maybe we could get better at sharing some of these big family homes, and older Australians talking about sharing and going back to the share house thing. And it's a strange concept for people who've lived their whole lives in a family home with their families, but it is perhaps getting a little bit more attention, a little bit more favour, because people are also thinking about being lonesome as well, and lonely, and sharing costs. And
I know some older people that have done it.
Yeah. I know older people doing it too. And there's a big issue around this. So definitely something has to change in terms of housing. A lot of people don't want to stay living in a great big family home either. They want to be able to get the mechanisms in place for them to move to somewhere smaller, but hopefully not too far from their own communities. And this is why some of that infill, smaller, medium density housing can come into play too.
Fran, the last time I did share housing, there would be fights over whose butter it was.
I love share houses. I love them.
I love hate them.
Oh, no. I'm a share house kind of girl.
Really?
Yeah, I loved it.
It says a lot about me too.
Grew up in a big family, you know?
Yeah. I'm like, don't touch my butter. Okay. Next question is
the
from
kitty.
Nigel.
Remember the kitty?
Look, I just can't even. Yeah. It's been a long time.
And you would have been that.
No, I wasn't all tight assy about it. Thank you very much. It
you was just more said, just don't about, touch my butter.
Yeah, but if you're going to just leave some Vegemite smeared on
top
of it.
Yeah, fair cop.
Thank you. Next question comes from Ross. Hi, Fran and PK. I reckon if an Aussie MP pulled the Nigel Farage stunt of resigning from his seat only to re-stand for it, there would be absolute outrage here. What do you reckon? Has it been done here, or would it even be allowed? Asks Ross. Fran.
I reckon Ross is right. I reckon we'd think, oh, this is just a stunt. This is not on, pal. We don't like going to elections. We really hate going to elections because we have to vote in this country. A lot of people don't like that. I personally love them, as do you, I know. But yeah, I think it wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't put up with it. Has it been happened in this way? Not that I know of. We did have the what's called the Citizenship 7. Remember that? There was a constitutional crisis in 2017 because suddenly a whole lot of people found that, you know, they were New Zealanders actually, and that was a real problem because you've got to be Australian citizen. So Barnaby Joyce, he was a New Zealand citizen still because he's got dual nationality. Fiona Nash, UK, Scott Ludlam, New Zealand, Larissa Waters, Canada. You know, it went on and there were seven of them and they were in breach of Section 44 of the Constitution, but they didn't know it. So they were disqualified from standing in our parliament. They had to resign and then recontest their seats. Larissa Waters came back to the Senate on a casual vacancy and was re-elected in 2019, as was One Nation's Malcolm Roberts in 2019. Matt Canavan, Nick Xenophon, they're also part of it, but the High Court ruled they weren't legally citizens of Italy and the UK respectively. So it was pretty complex for us to work out constitutionally, and we did it. But I think everyone understood that. That's the Constitution, which is held in high regard in this country. So it's kind of different to what Nigel Farage is trying to pull in the UK.
And Nigel Farage's stunt, I mean, he is, Fran, running against Binface.
Binface. I really can't get my head around Binface. I've had this argument with a lot of producers who love it.
Binface.
I don't love Binface. I think it's a mockery.
Fran!
think it makes a mockery. I know he is mocking. That's the whole thing. But I'm uncomfortable with Bin Face.
Bin Face is a gift to all of us. Fran?
We're going to have to agree to disagree on. Okay. Maybe I'm not thinking deeply enough in the right way about Bin Face. I just have a problem.
Oh, make some
interviewing
mockery.
A bin.
If it makes a mockery, that's exactly what we need right now. Thank you, Bin Face. And you know what? When Bin Face answers questions, I feel nothing but happiness and light in my heart. And, you know, that should happen more. I mean, thank you, Bin Face.
Okay.
All right. I've taken a stand. Yes, I've heard the other argument. Yeah, I've got to take politics seriously. It is serious. And if Bin Face...
It's not serious. Bin Face is serious.
I think Bin Face is a serious player. All right, next question. Okay. And this next one, I really love it. It'll be obvious in a second. It's James.
From Adelaide. Hi, James.
Hi, Fran and PK. Thanks so much for the amazing work on the podcast. I absolutely love it. James here. I saw PK on Afternoon Briefing this week saying that she likes to move fast when she was asking people about what potential moves may be in future budgets. So myself not wanting to get left behind, I thought to try and think ahead as well. So what do you think is the likelihood that the gas tax might actually become a campaign promise ahead of the next election? Tell me if I'm being wishful or if I'm missing something obvious, but I wonder whether that policy might actually be better suited for an election campaign. There does seem to be a fair amount of community support. The coalition is standing in opposition to it, and it might also address some of the concerns the Prime Minister has raised about why the tax shouldn't be implemented now. For example, the Iran war and the shortage of fuel. And to match PK's habit of sticking her neck out and making a call, my own suspicion as of today is that the Prime Minister may soon pull the plug on the GST deal that ScoMo struck with WA. What do you think? Thanks again, and long may the podcast live.
Okay, I love it because you reference Afternoon Briefing and the gas tax, and thank you for noticing. I love it when there's a sort of segue between all of the things I work on. Fran.
Okay, let's start with the first part. Do I think that the Prime Minister is going to take the gas tax to the election? I think there is a high possibility of it. I think it depends a little bit on how those big proponents of the tax, of the gas tax, people like David Pocock and some of the Greens and others, can manage to keep it, you know, up in the public profile. But I do think the government is always looking for a way to find new tax. It's also looking for a way to make renewables more attractive, and it sort of matches the government's values around this, if you like, their philosophy around this. But a new tax is always tricky, so they've got to build the case. They couldn't do it in the middle of this fuel crisis because the Prime Minister needed to go around to our many countries in our region who we are selling gas to and say, hey, we're selling you gas. Can you give us your other fuels that we needed? So he'd just done that, and that was about a question of sovereignty. However, I think he's sort of, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, given a few signals to those importers of our tax to say, this might change in the future and we're giving you due notice. So, yeah, I think there's a fair chance of it, James. I wouldn't bet on it because, as I say, selling a new tax is always a bit hard. But when it's a tax on someone that the voters think, well, they're getting a good deal anyway, look how much our heating bill's gone up, blah, 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 I think there's a good chance the government could go for it in some way. And I think there's a valid case for it.
Yeah, I mean, you were watching Afternoon Briefing and I asked Ed Husic about it. Now, he's on the backbench pushing for a gas tax and has actually, you know, just had this town hall with the AWU boss and Richard Dennis from the Australia Institute. So he's trying to build a movement around it in the Labor movement.
And Richard Dennis has just published an essay on this very issue, actually, so...
Yeah, and we've got National Conference of the Labor Party coming up. We've got all this stuff happening, which is all kind of, you know, perfect storm to build towards this momentum for this. The Prime Minister will only do it if he thinks, because he's a very astute political operator, as we know, if he thinks the politics is right, the mood is right for it. And I don't know if that will be the case by next budget, although people who are smarter than me say...
Next election, he's saying, not next budget, next election.
I'm saying next budget.
Next budget. Woo, there you go. Mm. Listen, on your other point,
James, about whether the PM's going to pull the plug on the GST deal that ScoMo stuck with WA. I really don't know at all. I haven't looked at this lately. It's very hard to do because WA may very well be in play again. I mean, Labor did very well there last time, and you notice the government didn't do any tricky things for WA last time. So I'm not convinced that they will change that.
Yeah, I mean, it goes on for a couple more years and they haven't guaranteed it for the next round. But yeah, it's a very contentious thing to try and change, but there's a lot of people who want them to. Well, that's it for the Party Room today, but keep sending your questions in. We love getting them, as I think we have demonstrated today. Send your voice notes to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
David Lipson will be back with Insiders on Background on Saturday because Spears is having a break. And then you'll be back with Politics Now on Monday through the week, PK.
That's right. And remember to follow Politics Now on ABC Listen so you never miss an episode. See you, Fran.
See you, PK.